You're listening to a podcast from the Rocking Vicar.
Coming up on this week's Parish Council, Magna Shaw and Coca-Cola. Oh, hello. Waking up with a stranger. Oh, how do people get Glastonbury tickets? BBC Music's God Only Knows video is reviewed and we clamber up onto the pretend soapbox.
Oh, hello everybody. Welcome back to the Parish Council, our podcast from the Rocking Vicar. Glad you could make it. I'm Magnus Shaw and he's all lost in the supermarket. He's Terence Dackham.
I will be with you in a moment. It's just I'm following a recipe from the Great British Bake Off. It does seem very complicated. So what I decided to do, instead of all that business with ovens and times, I'm just going to put it in the microwave. Crikey, that's hot. Oh, no, that's the smoke alarm.
Yes, yes, I can hear the smoke alarm.
I'm going to have to open all the windows now. And so meanwhile, you're going to entertain us with a less dangerous experiment,
well, I hope so. Who knows? Who knows what could happen? But an unusual thing occurred this week. A postman knocked on the door. I said, oh, I can't get through the letterbox, mate. I said, oh, thank you. So I took it up. It was like a cylindrical bubble wrap, sort of jiffy bag, cardboard tube type arrangement. So, oh, what on earth is this? So I tore into it, and inside this cardboard sleeve was a bottle of Coca-Cola Life. Not light. Mm. Not light.
No,
light. Yes. Coca-Cola.
F for Freddy.
Yes, exactly. L-I-F-E. Coca-Cola Life. It's exactly like the 500ml bottles that you see in the news agents there. Except the famous red and white label is, in this instance, a sort of goldy green and white. Noticeably different. It looks like a Coke bottle from another dimension where everything's slightly different. And the proposition here, the selling point here, is that they've sweetened it, but not with sugars, and you know how much sugar there is in your regular Coke there, and not with saccharin, but with, well, it says natural sources, which I'm led to believe is something called stevia, which is
The stevia leaf. I did a bit of research on this.
A sweet leaf. So anyway, I thought, oh, I'll glug this straight down, and I thought, oh no, I know what I'll do. I put it in the fridge. I thought, I'll allow you and our loyal listeners to share this moment with me. So,
This is fantastic.
It's been in the fridge.
This is groundbreaking.
Yes, it's been in the fridge since Wednesday, and I've got it here now. There it is. So I'm going to crack it open. I'm going to drink a big slug and I'm going to review it for you.
Oh, this is wonderful. This is rather like they used to do on Food and Drink, where that woman used to sort of, and Oz Clark used to sort of sniff wine.
That's right. I would have a taste of burnt blackberries or something.
Yes. Okay.
Here we go. You ready then?
All right.
Did you get that? There's a bit of a whoosh.
Yeah, with
there.
A little fizz there. Got that.
So the cap's off now. Here we go.
This is
here we go. Right. You hum or something while I take this.
We want to get the sound effect of you drinking. Oh, this is marvellous.
It's very fizzy.
Yes.
It's nicer than Diet Coke, which I can't really stand. It hasn't got that funny aftertaste of saccharin.
Yeah.
It's almost sweeter, actually, than regular Coke. It hasn't got that sort of bitter hit that you get with proper Coke. So it's probably sweeter than proper Coke. It's quite nice, actually.
Oh, good. Yeah. Well, now they'll be so glad that they sent you this free bottle.
It's very sweet. It's very sweet.
Do you know what? I was reading on the Coke UK website, and it says this. The stevia leaf is a source of intense natural sweetness, calorie-free, but wait for this, up to 200 times sweeter than table sugar. 200
I can believe
times
that,
sweeter.
Yeah.
So no wonder you're rocking back in your chair. But what I thought was, isn't there a genuine possibility that something 200 times sweeter than standard sugar might actually make you crave sugar even more intensely? So, okay, you're having a sugar-free fizzy drink, but you could be legging it down the shop to get a jumbo bar of fruit and nuts.
This is the electronic cigarette argument, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Maybe, yes. I mean, I would take that as a reasonable substitute over the full sugar Coke. Yeah, more so than a Diet Coke.
Are they paying you for this?
No, not at all. No, really not. No.
There wasn't a £10 note in that little cardboard.
I wish there was. No. I think I'd probably appear on some list of idiots who've worked in advertising and sent the odd thing like Coke Life. And the PR agency would be delighted because I've now brought it to the podcast, but I have not been paid. If it was revolting, I would have said it was revolting.
I watched the, knowing that you'd mentioned that this was coming along, I watched the excruciating company video yesterday. I must send you a link to this. It's stilted performances from UK Coke executives. Saying, yes, this is a new venture for us. But I'm not sure where this sits, because they've already got regular Coke, Diet Coke, Coke Zero.
I'm not sure
where this sits.
Yeah. I don't know what constitutes Coke Zero. For a long time, I thought it was Diet Coke, but aimed at blokes, which it might be. I don't know.
I'm not sure. It's zero calories, of course, and zero sugar.
But how are they sweetening that one? I don't know. Yeah, well, they've got a family of Coke now. Of course, it, in the good old US of A, the Coke family is about 20 strong, isn't it? There's orange Coke, lime Coke, vanilla Coke, cherry Coke, so on and so forth.
Having watched this, as I say, excruciating company video, I can reveal that they're all on their way as well, because they say in this video, we're widening the family. So they'll all be on the shelves.
I always wondered why, such a wide range in the States and not here, but perhaps there must be some marketing reason for that. Perhaps we just don't go for quite such a radical departure.
One thing I've noticed in American supermarkets, where we've got one aisle dedicated to soda drinks, they have two or three.
Yeah.
But the big selling point for healthier cola drinks over there is the caffeine free option, which we don't seem to do quite so much.
Oh, that's the gold one, isn't it?
Right.
We had a carton of that the other week. I think Mrs. the Magnashaw went to get some Diet Cokes and could only find the diet and caffeine free.
Yeah.
I think by taking the caffeine and the sugar out, I'm not sure what you've got.
Yes, I know. Yeah, there is that sort of what's the point sort of element to it, isn't it?
We do have those. But in the States, it's the whole range of soft drinks is never ending. It's 14 different brands of root beer before you even look at anything else, which is one of the joys of the States, I must say. It's not a complaint at all. And I love the grape soda and the root beer out there, just fantastic.
Lot of choice in your Florida supermarket.
Yeah, but in Coke alone, they've got goodness. I think they've got a root beer cola as well. A root beer Coke out there as well. Yeah, crazy.
Well, I can tell you they're all on the
way. Oh, good.
Now, I've said a couple of times recently that I've got more books in my reading pile than I'll ever have a chance to read in my lifetime. And also, I seem to need real inspiration to commit to a book these days. I don't know. It's just a phase I'm going through, as 10cc once said. However, when the second in the series of Danny Baker's autobiographies turned up last week, I thought I'd get in there. And of course, the reviews are right. It's an absolute hoot from start to finish. And I read it in two sittings, which I think says it all. It really does fit into that category of I couldn't put it down. But the book starts with Danny correcting a couple of omissions in the timeline of his first book. And I'm thinking he may have to do the same when the third volume of his memoirs is published. Because he's either forgotten or didn't have room for a story. He told me about his father, Spud. He told me this a couple of years ago. Uh-huh. And it just reminded me, I just thought I'd tell it now, because he told me that when Danny was working at the New Musical Express, and he managed to move on from being the receptionist at the NME and was now a full-time writer for the paper. And he was like, you know, it was really going well. He was zooming around the world on tour with The Clash, interviewing Michael Jackson. It was all beginning to take off. So he went to see his dad, and his dad hadn't quite grasped Danny's job role. So Danny Baker comes home after interviewing Kate Bush or someone and pops around to see his dad, and his dad says, "So, how's it going with that typing job at the paper, son?"
Yeah, well, he wasn't wrong, was he? I mean, essentially,
to
all intents and purposes, that was the job.
Now, Magnus Shaw, that's, yes, that is you. I don't know how good you are at getting up in the morning. I suspect Mrs. the Magnus Shaw might be needed here for us to get the full story. However, I'm going to try and tempt you to give a new app labelled as a social alarm clock a go. This is called the Wakey, and the Wakey app gives you a connection to a network of strangers all around the world, and one of them, always of the opposite gender, is selected to call to wake you up. Now, I want to see how this appeals to you, but let me give you a scenario. It's a Friday morning. You have to get up to record the podcast. And a woman from Moldova rings you up and shouts at you for 60 seconds. It seems ideal.
That sounds like a terrible idea. And not least of all, because who wants a stranger shouting at you first thing in the morning? But how do you know they're going to remember to do it?
Ah, well, there's a huge network around the world, and you know they all sort of queue up. But if someone isn't available, it's okay. There is a failsafe. You get a robot ringing you from the Wakey service because no one in the world can be bothered. They think, oh, make sure not the phone. So you get a robot instead.
I don't see the appeal. I don't know. It's a bit creepy that it has to be somebody of the opposite sex, isn't it? That's a bit creepy.
Well, I don't know where that leaves the LGBT rights in this.
Oh, that's very good point. Yes.
Well, the reason why they say the opposite gender, it's a bit of a weird bonus that maybe Mrs. the Magnus Shaw may not be so keen on this aspect of it, because they've incorporated this sort of vague dating element.
Now we're getting to the nub of it.
Yeah, the callers are always of the opposite gender. And you have your 60 seconds to decide if you wish to exchange details.
It all becomes clear now. Yeah. So
if this woman from Moldova thinks, oh, I like the sound of this Magnus Shaw, she's got 60 seconds to sort of impress upon you. I mean, obviously, there'd be queues of them for you. Accused of women around the world.
Yes.
And, you know, you have to decide whether your future may lie with this woman calling you from Moldova.
Yes, I think we're getting to the nub of it now, really. It's like a grinder for straight people with added alarm clock, isn't it, really?
There's that nature, yeah. And it doesn't sound like you're so keen. Maybe, I was thinking maybe they should merge with that other app that we discussed recently, and so the callers just yell yo at you, at you for 60 seconds.
Yo, yes, because that would improve things to no end.
That would get you up.
Yeah, I don't like any sort of alarm call, I have to say. I don't think, you know, we've made a wrong turn somewhere as human beings, where we at some point we all decided that one's sleep should be interrupted. And you should be brought to attention and forced into activity, because actually there's some scientific basis in this that act of having your sleep constantly interrupted every morning is quite bad for you over a period of time.
Sure, yeah.
I think electric light has a lot to do with it. The fact that you can get up and function at any time of day or night, because prior to that, I think people tended to go to bed at dusk and awoke. But, you know, woken by the light at dawn, and that is, I think, much much better for you as a human being. But to be pranged from a deep sleep by any kind of electronic noise, let alone somebody from Moldova shouting "yo," is, I think, very bad for you.
Oh, dear. Yeah. Well, it looks like you're not going to sign up for this. I rather like, talking about sleep, I rather like the Mediterranean siesta.
Yeah,
you
know, I don't, yeah,
oh,
there's
nothing better. No. Nothing better in the afternoon.
Sheer bliss. Just the best thing about being on holiday is getting to about 3 o'clock in the afternoon, 2 o'clock in the afternoon, and just saying, I'm just going to my room for a couple of hours, and that's it. No demands on your time, and you just read maybe a page of a book, put the book down next to you, close your eyes. Ha ha, come on. That's just fantastic.
That's living all right.
I agree with you. Why we don't do that in Northern Europe, I do not know, because it's just such a good idea.
Plenty of times whenever I've worked in an office, not that often, but when I have, about sort of 1:30, if only I could slip under the desk here and have a snooze for half
an
hour.
Well, I used to work at an advertising agency, and the guy on reception, I suppose following in Danny's steps there, but the guy in reception, he was the only one with the key to the chairman's office, because the chairman used to work around the network of offices, so he was only in London once a week, and he had the key to the chairman's office, and he'd let himself in there at lunchtime. He'd have his sandwich, lock the door behind him, and sleep till 2, and then come back on reception.
Oh, lovely, yeah. George Costanza got this right in Seinfeld. He had a little bed built for himself under his desk when he worked for the New York baseball team. That's the way to do it.
Yeah, it's just getting back out again, isn't it?
That's the draw.
The downer,
Link to that alarming story. There's a brand new hashtag going around, and this is bound to excite you.
Oh yeah, sure, no doubt.
Hashtag is bound to excite. It's the new sort of ice bucket challenge. It's the latest development. This time the hashtag is Wake Up Call, and it's aimed at raising awareness of the situation in Syria. And the deal is, you donate £5 to UNICEF and post a photograph of yourself waking up. Now, what I want to know, if I donate £5, could I persuade you to ask Mrs. the Magna Shaw not to take a photo of you in your bedchamber?
Yes, undoubtedly. Although, Mrs. the Magna Shaw has quite a collection of photographs of me asleep in various hotel rooms. Yeah, because it's her thing when we're on holiday is...
To take a photo of her husband asleep.
Yes, exactly, yes.
I suppose in case you ever upset her or divorce is in the offing, she could hold those against you.
Yeah, it's just because it's just to tease me, because she knows that, A, I will have said, don't take any photos of me on this holiday while I'm asleep. and she will concur, and then she will do it, and then she goes, look, here's one. And nobody likes a photo of themselves asleep.
I have a very deep theory about this. I think it's because it shows us too close to death.
Maybe it
troubles us psychologically. Why can't people, Magna Shaw, give to charity anymore without tipping a bucket of water over themselves or posting a picture of themselves peeping over a duvet? Give the money if you want to. You don't need to involve me in your eiderdown located activities.
Absolutely. I completely agree, and I really don't like the drift of this, because it's taken charity away from a sort of private, personal, dignified thing now to larks aplenty, and I resist that. I do give to two particular charities, but at the risk of...
Is one of them the Dacom Foundation? I'm launching...
That would be the last one I would give it to. Much like Smashy and Nicey, I don't like to talk about it. And so I genuinely don't. I think it's everybody's decision, and I think it's perfectly okay to give nothing to charity if that's your heartfelt decision. What I don't like is this. I challenge you to give something to charity. Nature of these round robin games is like, what if you genuinely don't want to? You're exposed then, aren't you? So, well, no, thank you. Then I was like, what's wrong with you? You don't want to make money for charity. I don't like all that. I was phoned by a charity the other day, a very well-known leading charity, who I'd given to as they were doing some crisis work, some emergency work a few years ago, and I gave them a one-off donation. And that was sufficient to put me on their database.
Oh, Lord, yeah.
And here we are, like three years later, my number pops up on their database and some fellow calls me and starts going on about covenants and direct debits and everything. And I wasn't rude, but I was very firm in my response, because I just I said, no, and I really, really resent you phoning me, coming back for more money. I said, you know, it's my decision if and when I give to your charity, and if and when, or, you know, whether or not it's you is my choice as well. You wouldn't phone up your grandma and say, you know, that check you wrote me at Christmas, have you got another one? at least you wouldn't if you wanted any sort of dignity in your life. So and I felt this was very much the same. He said, come on, you ponied up once, let's have some more. But I don't like it. I just don't like
that's as intrusive as those chuggers that are
exactly
on the high
street. Exactly the same thing. Yes. Yeah, exactly the same.
And this, you know, if you go to a major town, sometimes I feel like I need a kind of stick or something to beat them back, because you get past one and then there's another posse.
Absolutely.
of these people in cagoules.
I just think it is really shabby. I think it's removed the dignity and the seriousness of charitable causes. They would argue, well, we get three times more money annually by doing this than we would relying on the sort of private process. Well, okay, you know, so that still smacks of commercialising your good work, I think. I don't appreciate it.
What about the ones on the telly where you see a donkey stumbling along and, you know, just for £3 a month,
I know.
You can save the life of poor Smokey the donkey.
I suppose TV advertising,
You turn away, don't you? You turn the channel. I can just tell what you do, Max.
No, but that's not an intrusion, because you're in an ad break anyway, and it's not a one-to-one communication. So I can accept canvassing for donations via TV advertising. But I mean, it's when somebody, you know, on a personal basis intrudes into your life, either in the street or on the phone, or by inviting you to do the wake up or ice bucket challenge. I just think it's not for me. I don't like it. And I really, really resent the idea of this nominating somebody. Hey, you give some money now. That is really unfair.
Yes. Well, it's as if he needs some positive publicity at the moment, because Jeremy Clarkson, I don't know why anyone would advise him to go for some positive stories at the moment, but he was in on this wake up call hashtag yesterday, posting a photo of himself under the duvet with Heston Blumenthal. And of course, then it's the usual network. You know, there was Stephen Fry, who nominates Jemima Khan, who nominates Claudia Winkleman, and they're all in on it. And just give them money, for heaven's sake.
I couldn't agree more. That just fills me with absolute despair, that kind of malarkey. Yeah, I don't appreciate that at all, because no matter how well intentioned, it is all about look how well connected I am, and look at all my celebrity mates, and look at all this, how the world would be a much worse place without us famous people. Oh dear, it just makes me shudder.
I know, and a photo of Jeremy Clarkson leaning back on his pillow won't actually help the people of Syria at all.
Won't help anybody, I shouldn't imagine. No.
I'm going to pose you a question, Magda Shaw, and along with the listener, I have every hope that you can help me understand this conundrum that happens every year, every confidence. Earlier this week, tickets for Glastonbury 2015 went on sale, and all of them sold out, by the way, at a whopping £225. Yeah, and they sold out in 26 minutes, and this was before we even know that Fleetwood Mac are headlining. I think that's supposed to be a secret.
Yes,
but, you know. Yes, okay. Yet every year, so they're sold out, 26 minutes, and of course the social media was full of people saying, oh, this happens to me every year, I never get my tickets for Glastonbury and so on. And then every year, people I know are always there at Glastonbury. I don't know. Yes, of course, many of them are lovies, theatre and music people. But, my timeline on social media around the time of Glastonbury is always filled with people saying, well, here we go, off to Glastonbury again. Looking forward to see the old friends down. How do so many of the same people accrue Glastonbury tickets every year? You just must have the answer, Magnus Shaw.
Oh, I don't. I've no idea, except...
What a letdown.
Once again, one suspects some people, a good many people, are well connected. If it's supposed to be a random lottery as to who gets tickets, then, like you say, statistically, the same people getting them every year wouldn't happen. So one wonders, who knows who, isn't it?
Well, I fear it must do, and yet you would have thought that... the people, the Glastonbury experience and, young Miss Evis and old man Evis, that they seem quite committed to fairness and everything being, ecological and whatnot. Yeah. You would think that, I would hate to think that there's, sort of 20,000 tickets put aside for the former bass player from Blur and,
Yeah, I bet there is, though.
Well, I tell you what, though, someone in the know did give me a hot tip, and this is serious this week. So I was asking somebody about this, and they're in the industry, and they said, even if you don't plan to stay, it's no good for you next year, by the way, it's already gone. But the following, even if you don't plan to stay in the coach or caravan areas, apply for tickets there because they go on sale separately. And, fewer people, the odds are better in your favour on getting those tickets than if you're just going into the sort of lottery where they all sell out in, 20 minutes. There's more chance of getting the caravan area.
That's a good tip. It's just interesting the way the balance of power has shifted. Once upon a time, the person doing the vending was grateful for the customers.
Yes.
Now they're doing us a massive favour. Offering us tickets or ensuring that we can't get hold of tickets for their event. I know it's the law of supply and demand, but I just think they say, please, how can I get a ticket? If I got to that point, I'd start to think, hold on, what am I doing here? It's like, if I want a ticket, I'll expect to be able to buy one. If I can't buy one, I won't go.
You're right. It's an absolutely extraordinary twist around because before knowing that it's Fleetwood Mac, Muse, and AC/DC topping the bill next year, people are prepared to if you're a family or a group of four, you're only just short of £1,000 that you're committing.
That's before your petrol, your food, and
and of course this would all give me the heebie-jeebies trying to booking it for a year ahead. I couldn't cope. But my days and nights of shivering in a field while someone like Jesse J bellows, "Everybody say yeah!" They're long gone.
How you doing out there?
Yeah, Glastonbury. How you doing, Glastonbury?
Has any crowd ever shouted back, "Not so good, to be honest"?
Yes, I was feeling okay yesterday, but I had a bit of a sleepless night.
A bit of a sniff.
Yeah. No, you have to go, all right.
Yeah, you do. I'm terrible at that, though. I never yell back to any.
I'm sure I've mentioned this before. I've always of the attitude, I paid £225. You entertain me. Exactly. I'm not here to sing or shout at you. You do the entertaining. You're up there.
Put your hands in the air. No, you put your hands in the air.
You put your hands in the bloody air. Yeah, absolutely.
Exactly.
No, I might watch some of it from the comfort of my sofa, but that's only so long as it doesn't clash with Grand Designs or the Great British Bake Off. But you still go to one or two of these festivals?
Now and again, yes. Yeah, well, only one. I go to Cornbury, and I only go to
that. Do they send you a free ticket?
Yeah, they sent me a free ticket, yes, yeah.
No doubt there'll be a supply of Coca-Cola Life waiting for you.
One year at Cornbury, one of the sponsors was that dairy-free yoghurt. I can't remember what it's called now.
That's surprising for us all that you haven't actually plugged that.
There was a big stand in the arena for this dairy-free yoghurt. And lots of giveaways, of course. Either they'd failed to sell as much dairy-free yoghurt as they were expecting, or the promotional people had failed to give away as much as they were supposed to, because on the morning, the Monday morning after the festival had finished, there were people going around with shopping trolleys saying, how much of this yoghurt can you take home with you? We must have brought, 60 cartons of this yoghurt back with us. The fridge was stacked high. We were going door to door in the neighbourhood saying, do you want some free yoghurt? It's non-dairy. Non-dairy, by the way. That Coke Life's repeating on me now.
So I knew there was a danger to this big experiment.
Exactly, so I've got Windy Pops now, yeah.
Oh, yeah, great. Thanks for letting us know.
Not only did I have a free ticket for the festival, I came back with more dairy-free yoghurt than I knew what to do with.
Actually, talking of dairy and your current problems there with the drink that you've taken, you know, it's funny, isn't it? It's only when you get really experienced on radio and so on that you realise, you know, that advice that you're given in the very early days is, you know, don't drink milk, don't drink tea just before you go on air. And it's so tempting, you know, if you're a fan of your Coca-Cola or your fizzy drinks or milk or milky tea or something, to have such a drink by your side when you're broadcasting, but oh boy, I think it never works out.
I think every broadcast I've ever done, I've had done with a cup of tea, so I'm hopeless.
you're never going to do the breakfast show on Radio 1. I'm sorry.
that's starting to dawn on me now. That ship has sailed, I think.
I fear it has. On Tuesday evening at 8 o'clock this week, the BBC continuity announcers across the television network, they weren't voicing the usual, and now on BBC One, Holby City.
Oh, yeah.
Now, instead, all channels came together for the screening of a 2.5-minute video that was 2 years in the making, from Dave Grohl to Pharrell Williams and 1D, came an attempted homage to the Beach Boys and the vision of promoting the BBC music brand. Did Florence Welch have you in tears with her contribution to God Only Knows, Magnus Shaw?
No, what occurred to me about this was that we've done it before. Pre-hype was suggested something extraordinary was going to happen. And you can over-promote something, and this was terribly over-promoted. And so when it rolled out, I thought, well, this is Perfect Day, done not quite as well, because I think that Perfect Day video, certainly, I've probably seen it too many times now, but certainly the first time it aired was quite compelling. It had a really nice atmosphere to it, and you were drawn into it. But you can't really do it again without the law of diminishing returns kicking in. And when the project was greenlit, let's produce a promo for BBC Music, let's all sit down around a table, you know how the BBC people like to sit round tables. The best that anybody could come up with is we could do another Perfect Day. That's quite disappointing, really, I think.
An 80-piece orchestra and, quote, 27 ridiculously talented musicians, end of quote. Not quite so sure about that bit. It did remind me, rather, of the John Lewis Christmas commercials.
Yes, yeah.
Saved by the sight of my heroine, Eliza Carthy, oddly on a carousel horse.
Oh, yes. But
here there was a twist, because I was going to say, you know, about Perfect Day, of course we didn't have social media in those days, and this I think was the difference with the God Only Knows video, is that it was being plumped up on fluffed up on particularly Twitter for a week or so prior to the unveiling.
Well, that's my point. I just say it was overhyped, and I even before I knew what this thing consisted of, I thought I can't see how this is going to be as good as they're maintaining. But when it was a sequel to something they'd done before, that was, I thought it was a particular letdown, I thought.
There was a strange twist afterwards, because suddenly it was announced and we found out that it's also the charity single for children in need.
Yes.
Which is fine, and of course the presence for... Well, all of 5 seconds I counted of One Direction, that guarantees the number one slot, because all the 1D fans will buy it just for that 5 seconds. So money in the bag. Of course, if you don't want to buy it, here's a difference as well now, because it can be legally streamed, and that will go towards the money for children in need, or everywhere from Google All Access to Spotify. So, but I thought, that wasn't mentioned at all until after it had been shown, I suppose, because it might have been a bit of a spoiler.
Yeah, again, I just think it's all very unimaginative. For that very reason, because we've seen it done before, and that's where the disappointment comes in. It's a beautifully shot, Brian Wilson there at the end, but that's
looking a bit confused.
Well, yeah, bless him. Though. Yeah, that's his usual mode, isn't it? But. It was almost, frame for frame, Lou Reed's Perfect Day, in that Lou Reed sang the last line of Perfect Day on that compilation. I just thought it was uninspired, because I'd like to think they could have come up with something more interesting. I think the best take on that sort of idea was the one Peter Kay did, where all the children's characters came together in one clip, because that was fascinating, because of course you've never seen those characters together in one place before, and it wasn't a straight lift from Perfect Day, although it was vaguely inspired by it. That was much more imaginative and entertaining than what we have here.
Very interesting point raised by Tracy Thorne yesterday, which resonated with me and helped me understand why I can never warm to these multi-artist sort of deals. When the vocal jumps from one voice to another after every line, Tracy Thorne was saying that our ears, our minds can't cope with the sudden changes. And that's really hit home to me. That always jars with me, and that's why I can't listen happily to Band-Aid or those similar things without wincing, because good luck and all that. But I find it quite hard listening, because you're just listening to... four words, and then somebody else comes in with four words, then somebody else comes in, and so on. And we don't like that. We like a sort of smooth melody line.
Yeah, I think that's probably true. I don't think this is made for listening as such, is it? This is an event, in inverted commas.
Oh, I see.
However, show me the man who says he recognised all 27 artists, and I will show you a liar.
I know. I had to cheat and look up several of them. Sam Smith and Jazz Darmy, and I didn't know who they were. I have to
admit.
On another point, Magnus Shaw, we were told with Bob Shannon being interviewed. I'm sure he comes across terribly well when he's interviewed. But anyway, BBC Music need branding? This was what Bob Shannon was getting at, that it brands the BBC's commitment to music right across the network, and this sort of cross-promotion. Don't we know of the existence of Radio 1, 2, 3, 6, Radio 1, extra, without this need for them all to be branded? Can't they just be there?
When you've got a pot of other people's money, you can indulge in these things, I think, is the answer to that. I think if you said to somebody, particularly with radio, if you said to somebody, if you listen to a BBC radio station, what do you get? I think most people say, well, they play music, don't they? I think that's taken as read, isn't it? But as somebody who's worked in this field, branding is important. Whether this is the perfect execution to promote BBC Music, I'm not entirely sure. But I don't think it does any harm to build your brand. Whether you need to spend 2 years making a film to do it is a different question.
Well, I wonder if, sort of trying to cross-promote, across the boundaries, if a One Direction fan goes either online to download this today, or pops into, well, they'll have to travel through several towns to find a record shop. But if they manage to find a record shop and buy this as a hard copy, and they're a One Direction fan, they're oh, there they are, there's the lads.
Yeah.
Will they notice that between 1 minute and 20 seconds and 1 minute and 22 seconds, Nicola Benedetti plays a little bit of violin?
Mm-hmm.
And will they then say, do you know what? I'm heading off to Radio 3 at once.
No, of course they won't. But
so it's only going to appeal to the people it already appeals to.
Oh yes, but to a certain extent, that is perhaps what branding is all about. This isn't an advertisement. It hasn't been called as such, as far as I'm aware. But a brand raising exercise is really there to create goodwill around a particular organization or service or product. And the idea is not to convert One Direction fans to Radio 3. It is to create goodwill from all audiences around the brand BBC Music.
Well, I suppose
that's the difference between branding and advertising.
Yeah, oh, I guess so. Yes, I take your point. But you know, apart from the children in need charity bit, I do sort of speculate what did it actually achieve.
Oh, yeah. Don't get me wrong. I'm not saying and this is the best branding exercise you will ever see. I'm just saying that's what its intention, I guess, was. But as we quite often see from the BBC, it's rather terribly self-indulgent. So really more a case of navel gazing than anything else.
Yes, I guess so. Now, I didn't mention this to you before, but Peter Hitchens, he actually called up during the week and he was asking, uh-huh, if he could have a slot on the pretend soapbox.
Oh well, he'd be the kind of person who'd enjoy that, I think. Yeah.
Ah, well, you see, well, the trouble is, you see, I turned him down because I said the first place this week is reserved for Magnus Shaw.
Oh yeah, he'd have to take his place in the queue, of course. Mr. Hitchens never one to refuse a microphone, I've often found.
No.
But no, you're right. He must take his place behind me and indeed all the others. Well, obviously, you may have noticed that the general election campaign hasn't begun. You know, hasn't begun.
Oh, right.
Yeah, no way.
Right.
They'd have told us if the general election campaign.
Oh, I see. Oh, right. Okay. Yeah, okay.
Is it officially? No.
Yeah, it has to be officially announced.
Yeah, so
okay.
Officially, no campaign running at the moment. But, just for the sake of argument, imagine it had begun.
Okay.
Imagine Mr. Clegg was telling us he was going to fix mental health services, not in an attempt to convince himself the beckoning netherworld of total political oblivion was mere months away, but rather to convince us that he was worth voting for. Mr. Cameron was, proposing to give back every penny we'd ever paid in income tax or something like that, not in pursuit of a smaller, leaner state, but by way of charming us into giving him our pencil cross when the election comes next year. Or, for instance, imagine Mr. Miliband was...
Mr. Miliband!
Yes, well, imagine he was promising... whatever it is he's promising, not in an attempt to acquire some much-needed statesmanship, but to steer us to his party as we enter the polling booth in 2015. No. Well, great, because, of course, that's exactly what they have been doing. The gun may not have sounded, but this shady triumvirate is scampering down the track as fast as you like, elbowing each other out of the way in the hope of hitting the tape first and taking power. Just one question. Why are they doing it? What on earth is the point of them previewing their election manifestos when we all know that those pledges are worth naught? And they're worth naught because there is nothing to prevent them from reneging on each and every one should they ever gain a modicum of power. And one of them presumably will. So, this is my proposition straight from the pretend soapbox this week. Manifesto pledges from political parties should be legally binding. Should a governing party reverse or fail to implement a major measure contained in their pre-election literature, they should face a judicial process. Now, within that process, if they can present a reasonable explanation as to why they haven't delivered what they said they would deliver, or indeed delivered the opposite, then a court will surely acquit them and everybody would be happy. But if they cannot, then they will be censured, they will be fined, or even worse. Otherwise, what is the value of the election campaign? We may as well allocate seats in Parliament based on shoe size. So let's focus the minds of those who govern us. Let's make them stick to their promises or face 12 men and women, good and true. That's what I say. Legally binding manifesto pledges. That is my soapbox.
So in your Brave New World, yes. If, for example, Nick Clegg, let's just pick him. Say he stood behind a banner a few days before the general election, and the banner pledged that the Liberal Democrats wouldn't increase tuition fees.
Just for example.
Yeah, it's just an example. And then a few weeks later, he voted for a threefold multiplication in tuition fees. You'd have him up before the beak.
Quite so. Yes, absolutely I would. Yes, yeah.
I still remember Barack Obama, before his first election, yeah. I think, mm-hmm. Saying that, that he would definitely close Guantanamo Bay.
I know, yes, yes.
It's still there.
That is my case in point.
I'm agreeing with you all over.
Politicos will sing from the very heights about how the democratic process works. As we lay our programme of legislation and activity before the public, and if they like what they hear, they can vote for us and we will take power. But that's not what happens. They lay in front of the public a smorgasbord of delicious, tempting morsels. And then when they get into government, they give us gravel to eat. And that just completely undermines the democratic process. And it's a fraud. And they need to be accountable for that.
I always remember as well rather unlamented reign of Richard Nixon, where he was always telling us that peace is at hand with the Vietnam War. Yeah. And, essentially, as he was saying that, the Agent Orange was being delivered upon the people of North Vietnam. I wonder, I agree with you totally. I think it's a great idea. I wonder, we're recording this the day after UKIP, the UK Independence Party, have made substantial gains in two by-elections, winning one seat and coming jolly close in another. And if they were to sweep through the land next May in the election, I wonder quite how easy it would be. What timeline will they commit to get the country, as they put it rather simply, out of Europe? And there are other pledges in regard to the number of people in the country. I would love to see that examined in some detail so that, I'm not saying, whether they're a good party to vote for or not, that's an individual point of view, but I would like to see some of these claims examined a little bit more closely to see how long it would take for some of their core initiatives to be actually carried through.
Well, of course, I think there are very important signatures on very important pieces of paper which would preclude the possibility for, I don't know, decades, isn't it, of us leaving the EU. I think, talking about legally binding, I think we're legally bound, aren't we?
Well, this is my point. So therefore there would have to be major legislation even get that process underway.
So. I mean, this is where you have to slightly doff your tam o' shanter to Alex Salmond, because he said, I will, bring the country to, I'll bring Scotland to the point of a referendum on independence. And he did that. For years and years preceding that, he was told it would never happen. He didn't have a cat in hell chance. Unfortunately, he fell at the last hurdle, but he did deliver what he promised to deliver. That was quite impressive.
So if a representative from a political party knocks at my door, or more, well, of course they wouldn't get in through the gates, you know, they would be outside the property. So if I speak to them through the buzzer, and they say to me, "Look, vote for us, and we'll deliver fresh toasted tea cakes to you every afternoon at 4 o'clock."
Yes.
You think I should be, you know, an element of scepticism?
I think, yes, an enormous amount of scepticism. I'm just seeing you now as Montgomery Burns. the representative of whichever party. Hello, I'm your candidate for the forthcoming elections. And I could just see Terence go, "Unleash the bees." So I think that's right. Yes, you should unleash the bees, very much.
Unleash
so.
The bees. The,
if only the allegorical bees of scepticism, yes.
I have alligators in the moat, you know.
no doubt about it, yes. I'm just looking forward to meeting your Smithers.
I've got a whole team of them. Waiters and waitresses, Magna Shaw. Waiters and waitresses, again. I know. I've got to draw them in. I know it's a tough job. I realise that many are on minimum wage and relying on tips to keep afloat. I really do get it. Being a waiter is a job I couldn't do. I would be sacked within 10 minutes, if that. The first customer who complained or tried to be a smart aleck with me, I'd tell them to F off and I'd be dismissed on the spot. I know that. It must at times be tedious and exhausting. But I'm begging all waiters and waitresses to cut out the latest style of small talk that has crept in during that awkward moment when you've put your PIN into the little machine and there's a brief delay. You know, the thing connects, it approves the payment, prints out that useless additional receipt, another pointless piece of paper to stick in your wallet or purse. And while that PIN thing is happening, there's about 10 seconds to fill. Waiters and waitresses everywhere, silence is fine. You don't have to fill that 10-second gap at all. Here's the latest that keeps cropping up. Instead of saying, weather's clearing up nicely, I think. Instead, I can just about cope with that. The new one, it's a horribly open question, and this gets delivered to me more and more often. So, what are you doing for the rest of the afternoon?
Oh no.
They couldn't care less. They've got a smile, but they couldn't care less. This is creeping in everywhere. What are you doing for the rest of the afternoon? It puts me in a tailspin.
You could have a selection of smart answers, though, couldn't you? I thought I might hide naked in the bushes in the park.
This is true. I mean, I bite back on the words, mind your own effing business, I have to say. But I start stumble for a reply because I suddenly feel like saying, I plan to fall asleep on the sofa watching the 3:15 from Fakenham on the At the Races channel. You know, that just doesn't feel right. It feels terribly wrong, in fact. So I just bluster something like, just doing some shopping. I suppose some shopping. You know, all my sort of lunch companions sniggering to themselves. It's even worse, though, if the little receipt takes longer than expected and then the waiter feels the need for a supplementary. So they'll go, shopping. Anywhere nice? And, I get this kind of clammy, rising sense of panic. So I'm saying, waiters and waitresses, don't ask your lunchers what they're doing this afternoon. I mean, in some cases, you'd rather not know, as you said. I'm tempted to say, I'm going to a funeral, actually, you know, I'm taking my cat to the vet. She's got to be put down.
Oh, no.
Then see what response you get. I mean, But, you know, what if the truthful answer was, oh, you know, I'm going into hospital, I've got to have a limb amputated this off.
And come back in the next day with your leg strapped up behind you. Yeah.
Oh, I've got to go back to court, I'm being sentenced this afternoon.
Yes, all this...
Oh, well, back to Broadmoor. Actually, they only let me out on day release.
Yeah, this is my warden.
Yes.
Yeah, this would all be highly amusing. But I must object, really, because these people are just trying to be pleasant. They're trying to make your stay in their restaurants jovial and interactive. And I think you're being most unfair. You've seen these horrific restaurants in sort of old films, very, very expensive, posh London restaurants, which seem to be very, very echoey and full of clatter and cutlery, and the waiters stand in starched shirts to be summoned to the table in silence.
What's wrong with
that? No, that's awful. That's really bad. I think the problem just arises is that we Brits are so bad at social interaction. We're awkward and stumbling and fumbling, and so that's our lookout. We should get better at social interaction, and the only way we get better is if there was more of it. So I think these guys and girls of the hospitality trade are actually pushing us forward to be more comfortable talking to strangers, and that's a good thing.
I don't want them to be my friend.
No, well, they don't want to be your friend. I'm quite sure of that.
Especially after the tip.
Yes. What they also don't want is you to go. Yes, exactly. Yeah. What they also don't want is to for you to go away and say, "Don't go and eat in Le Garçon Bistro because they're a right miserable lot." You know, when I was paying with my card, they just stood there staring at me, which is what a lot of people would complain about.
I don't mind them smiling. I don't mind them saying, "Oh, it says busy in here this lunchtime," or, you know, if they must, you know, looks like we've got a spot of rain on the way. But don't ask me what I'm doing this afternoon.
Well, okay.
They don't want to know, and I don't want to tell them.
Yes, but they're trying to engage with you and appear interested in you as the customer. God only knows the service in this
what co- I'd be without you.
To throw back to the BBC clip, the service we receive in this country is shabby enough as it is without insisting that we're served in silence. There's plenty of places you can go where they'll do that by default because they are treating you with utter contempt. So I like a little chat, even if it's completely inconsequential.
I'm sticking to my guns. My message to waiters and waitresses everywhere around the world is, don't ask, don't tell.
Well, my message then is, then stand there and glare at Mr. Dacham while you're operating his transaction on your machine, because he doesn't want a bean of you. I, however, would be happy to have pass the time of day with you, because I think that is the civilised way. We are both desperate misanthropes, but he is clearly the worst of the two. Well, yes, two very reasonable positions, I think. Sealed in a capsule and buried in a garden called the Pretend Soap Box, which will be back next week. And that brings us to a close. We're off to the Slug and Cheese Grater to share a cocktail or two with the bloke who used to be inside the Orinoco costume in the Wombles. He's launching a solo career, and we're going along to support that. Thanks very much to the somnambulance Terence Dacham for his input. I'll be seeing you, and to Rona Martin for those lovely introductions. And there's more for you at therockingvicar.com, as always. But for now, it's farewell to you, our favourite listener, and bye-bye.
You have been listening to a Dacom Shaw Media production.
Voters would have to believe that every politician is some sort of combination of Superman, Santa Claus, and Mother Teresa. Superman, because he can do anything.
I will keep taxes low.
I will cut taxes.
To balance the federal budget.
We will guarantee health care for anyone who needs it.
Why are we continually disappointed in presidents? Because they couldn't possibly live up to the powers and the faith that we're investing in them.
Take the promise of energy independence. Every president since Nixon said he would end
this intolerable
excessive dependence on
foreign energy sources.
they promise
is to bring us closer to energy
independence for our country
by 1980.
By 1985.
In 10 years.
By the year 2025.
But today, America is no closer to independence than we were when...
Well, I'm not a crook.
Nixon was president.
I promise you.
Politicians tell us what we want to hear. And we do.
It's kind of an instinctive reaction. Government should do more on health care. Government should do more for children. But a president can't fix all the problems in your life.
It's like that movie Dave, where the president is a bad, selfish man who's then replaced by a lookalike who's good.
The good guy replaces the bad president, and he just calls in an accountant, and they sit down and balance the budget and get everybody a job.
I forgot that I was hired to do a job for you.
If the president were a good man, he'd get everybody a job. I saw it in the movie.
Create more and better jobs
that pay well and can't be outsourced.